It's been 52 years since Walter O'Malley moved the Brooklyn Dodgers to Los Angeles, and many New Yorkers are still holding a grudge. In a new book, Forever Blue, the true story of Walter O'Malley, Michael D'Antonio reexamines O'Malley's place in the history of baseball and in the histories of Brooklyn and Los Angeles. It's published by Riverhead Books, and I'm pleased that it has brought Mr. D'Antonio back to our show today. Welcome.
My pleasure, Leonard.
Weren't many New Yorkers outraged when Walter O'Malley was finally inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame? Pete Hamill wrote, "Never forgive, never forget," and declared that the Hall of Fame had lost all moral authority.
They're still outraged. The book came out yesterday, and my email address, my inbox is full of old Dodger fans and young Dodger fans who are still very upset about the loss of the team.
Now, I've always been curious about this because I was a Dodgers fan, so I understand. But the Giants may have been as popular or more popular than the Dodgers, and yet if you look over the literature since the move, it's pretty much all Dodgers.
Isn't that amazing? And the outrage in 1957 was pretty much all directed at O'Malley. I think in part it was because he spent 11 years saying, "I need a new stadium, I need a new ballpark, help me get a new ballpark." And Horace Stoneham, owner of the Giants, just quietly negotiated with San Francisco and announced one day in 57, "I'm leaving." And here O'Malley is the one who tried to stay, and he gets all the hatred, and Stoneham just, they say, "Goodbye, have a good trip."
They both had ballparks that were difficult to play in. Polo Grounds was one of the weirdest ballparks I ever saw. And Ebbets Field, much loved,
yes,
was a little too small.
It was a little too small. And you sat there. I never attended a game at Ebbets Field. But people may not know, but for the fact that a Dodger executive was related to a fire marshal, there were many seasons when that ballpark shouldn't have opened. I mean, it really was in disrepair. It was a great ballpark to play in. Don Newcomb told me how the peculiarities of it made him focus better. But I think watching a game there, especially if you needed to use the restroom, could have been a challenge.
On the other hand, you felt like you were right on top of the play, which
oh, yes,
was fabulous. So when was Walter O'Malley inducted into the Hall of Fame?
Last summer.
And so there were many years later. So do you think that it took so long because of resistance from old Brooklyn Dodgers fans?
Oh, I think so. I think there was resistance from the fans, resistance from some of the sports writers. There evolved this strange tradition of bashing O'Malley. It was started by Dick Young and taken up by Pete Hamill. There were fellas at the Times who did it too, and I understand why. You know, the book is called Forever Blue for two reasons. One is the folks in Brooklyn still are blue, and the other is Dodger blue. So it's a real pain that people feel.
Is yours a revisionist history? Did you write this book because you felt that O'Malley had been given a bum rap?
I didn't start out with any preconception. I think all history is revisionist. Every new book revises what we saw before. So
at least if it has new research.
Yes. And I had the notion that there was a great untold story there. I'm not a Dodger fan. I wasn't an L.A. guy or a New York guy. I just thought, here's a man from baseball history who's been neglected. His story has never been told. And I went to the O'Malley family with that message, that I will tell the story I find, and they turned me loose in the man's papers.
You're going to tell me that they didn't try to influence you at all get a new assessment of their father?
It was all my idea. They definitely wanted someone who would be open-minded, and they wanted someone who would be fair, but they didn't ask for any review of the manuscript. They didn't suggest any specific ideas, except that they loved him. You know, every son and daughter loves their dad. But it was supposed to be a clear, no-holds-barred bit of research, and that's what I did.
And did you come up with a lot of new stuff?
Sure. One of the most amazing things is to be in papers like that, open a file, and see a letter Jackie Robinson wrote in his own hand from a hotel in Chicago. And in it, he begins by saying, "Dear my O'Malley." And this is 1956. So everybody who thinks that Robinson hated O'Malley and O'Malley hated Robinson needs to consider that the two of them exchanged letters trying to establish a better relationship. They didn't want to not get along.
But then O'Malley traded Jackie to the hated Giants.
Well, yeah, I think it was more Buzzy Bavezzi, the general manager, who did that. And that was a terrible blow for a lot of Dodger fans. But really, Jack Robinson's problem was that Branch Rickey left, and Branch Rickey was his surrogate father in Brooklyn.
So let's talk about that for a moment. Branch Rickey brought Jackie Robinson to the Dodgers. He really did create the Dodgers that most people loved. And hasn't O'Malley been accused of forcing him out?
Well, he absolutely did create the Dodger team that people loved. He created the Dodger way. He created the camp at Vero Beach that just this year was the first year they didn't have the Dodgers there.
The great minor league system?
Absolutely. And they would bring 600, 700 players to Dodger Town. And he really was a pioneer and an innovator. What I discovered in doing my research was that instead of O'Malley pressuring Rickey to sell, it was actually Rickey who started shopping his shares around and wanted to get out. In fact, he went to Joseph Kennedy, the president's, the soon-to-be president's father, and tried to get him to buy his shares. There was discussion of making Jack Kennedy the president of the Dodgers before he became president of the United States. The negotiation that followed, everyone thinks O'Malley was the great manipulator, but in fact, Rickey had a buyer in his pocket. He was contractually obligated to negotiate first with O'Malley, but he had somebody behind him saying, I'll keep topping what O'Malley offers you.
Do we know who that is?
It was Galbraith, the president of the Pittsburgh Pirates, the owner, and a great real estate developer. And he also wanted Rickey to come to Pittsburgh. So in the end, Rickey gets $1 million, and O'Malley has to send an extra $50,000 to the guy who was backing him.
Now, why were the Dodgers so important to the Brooklyn sense of identity? In World War II movies, there was always a guy from Brooklyn who would go to great lengths to find out if the Dodgers had won that day.
Yeah. Well, and there were people all over America. This is what's amazing, is they were not just Brooklyn's team. In many people's hearts across America, they were America's team. And I think it's because in the 30s, they were perennial losers, and people called them Dem Bums and the Daffiness Boys, but they were lovable. And then they started to win, especially after World War II. So they became...
Although they could never win the big one.
Well, not till 55, that's right. And I think that's partly why people loved them. Isn't that the case with all of us? Only one person wins the championship. It's easy to relate to somebody who doesn't quite get there.
Yeah, but when you look at the Dodger teams from the time Jackie Robinson arrives on till the time they win the World Series, these are almost like all-star teams, one great player at every position. You would have thought that they would have won the World Series.
They were great. They were a great team, and they were also pioneers in integration. Before they won the series in 55, they were the first team to ever field a majority black team on the field. I think people saw them as an example of excellence, sometimes perennially thwarted by the Yankees. And it's also, you know, the Yankees were even then a team a lot of people liked to hate because they were so powerful and so professional. So you had this combination of a great and talented Brooklyn team that didn't quite make it.
Well, you mentioned that you found a letter from Jackie Robinson to O'Malley. What was his relationship with his players? Did he work it out with Jackie Robinson?
They did work it out. In fact, in the 60s, there's a series of notes back and forth between them. And before Jack died, he went to Dodger Stadium in Los Angeles after telling everybody he'd never go to the Dodgers again. And they honored him, and he met with Peter O'Malley, and the families came together. In fact, I talked to Rachel Robinson, and she says, you know, much too much has been made of their arguments in the 50s.
Well, he definitely didn't try to reverse the integration of the team. If anything, the team, as you say, picked up more and more great black players at a time when the Yankees had pretty much remained all white.
Yeah.
The Boston Red Sox had remained white. The the Washington Senators. There were any number of teams that were resisting integration way into the time when baseball was integrated.
Yeah, and O'Malley, his concept was that he was a professional owner. He was not a manager. He was not a player. So he actually had less contact in terms of interfering with what happened with the players than most owners did.
So he's not George Steinbrenner.
Not at all. In fact, you know, look at this. This guy had one manager, Walter Alston. In the whole time that he ran the team, one manager. Imagine that today.
Now, you talked to a number of the surviving players, Duke Snyder, Maury Wills, Carl Erskine. How did their memories shape your perceptions of Walter O'Malley?
They did very much shape it. Erskine was the fellow who went to Ebbets Field the day that they started to knock it down. And there's a great picture of him in the book next to a wrecking ball that's painted to look like a baseball. He was brokenhearted about the Dodgers leaving, and he never adjusted to going to L.A. But at the same time, he admired O'Malley. Erskine has a mentally disabled son, and the story that he always tells is every time my son came to the game, Walter was the one who went and got him a hot dog and made sure it had the mustard on it he wanted.
So they all liked him?
Generally they liked him. I think some of them were afraid of him. You know, he was the powerful owner, and when you're the boss, you engender a bit of fear. And also, these were the days when there were no real contract negotiations. They said, here it is, take it or leave it.
And so they all went to L.A. with the team.
Most of them did. And, you know, I was privileged to speak to Johnny Padres before he died, and he told some great stories about going wild in L.A. and how they all sort of went Hollywood, at least for the first year.
How big a business was baseball in the 50s?
Not nearly what it is today.
The Dodgers always sold out. They had always had over a million attendance in this bandbox of a field that they played in.
They were very successful. And there were dips, strangely enough, after they won pennants, and there was a dip after they won the World Series. And I think that had more to do with what was happening in Brooklyn as a whole than the team's appeal. They made money in Brooklyn. And no one can say, well, Walter O'Malley fled because he was going broke there. He left because he was terribly frustrated about the stadium, and he got a great offer.
Was Brooklyn going through any changes at the time?
Oh, sure. But this is something people are a little confused about. Yes, Brooklyn was undergoing demographic changes. Thanks to Robert Moses' highways, a lot of people were moving to Long Island. But the idea of it collapsing economically is not true. There were still jobs there. There are still vibrant communities, just as there are today.
I'm glad you mentioned Robert Moses. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, we'll talk about Robert Moses. We'll talk about the place that Walter O'Malley wanted to build, a new stadium, and whatever else. And his impact and the team's impact on Los Angeles. My guest is Michael D'Antonio. His latest book, Forever Blue, The True Story of Walter O'Malley, Baseball's Most Controversial Owner, and the Dodgers of Brooklyn and Los Angeles. It's published by Riverhead Books. Stay with us. We're back with Michael D'Antonio, the author of any number of books, Atomic Harvest, Tin Cup Dreams, Mosquito, The State Boys, Rebellion, Hershey. His work has appeared in most of the major publications, New York Times Magazine, Los Angeles Times Magazine, Esquire, et cetera, et cetera. And he is he shared a Pulitzer Prize when he was at Newsday. His latest book is called Forever Blue, The True Story of Walter O'Malley, Baseball's Most Controversial Owner and the Dodgers of Brooklyn and Los Angeles, published by Riverhead Books. You're not a sports writer, and I wonder how you wind up coming up with this as an idea for a book.
Well, you know, I think a good writer, a good journalist looks for the stories no one else has told, but that still matter to folks. And there was this big empty field where O'Malley was concerned. A lot of people had written around him, but no one had ever gone straight at the guy and tried to reveal him.
Well, he wanted to build a field in a big empty space that is controversial again today.
Right.
Bruce Ratner wants to build an arena where Walter O'Malley wanted to build a new stadium,
well,
Atlantic Yards.
This spot back in the late 1940s was home to a public market that was all meat dealers and butchers, and surrounded also by retail meat shops. It was one of the worst places in the world to wander through on a summer day. You can imagine the gutter ran with blood. And
it's like the meatpacking district of Manhattan until recently.
Right. And in those days, the housing around it was all substandard. He saw this property, and also there was usable space over the Long Island Railroad tracks and a lot of redevelopment going on citywide, controlled by Robert Moses. And he naturally saw this as the best spot to find a big enough parcel to put up a urban baseball stadium.
So what was the problem?
The problem was Robert Moses. Moses had, in the 1930s, 15 years before O'Malley came along, already identified Flushing as the spot for a baseball stadium. He was never going to help anyone build a stadium in Brooklyn.
Didn't he have a relationship with O'Malley's father, Edwin O'Malley?
Yes, and this is the opening of the book, is Edwin O'Malley at a table in City Hall confronting a panel from Albany that's trying to clean up politics in New York. Walter O'Malley's dad, Edwin, was an old Tammany Hall Paul, and he was at that time commissioner of public markets, which was about the most corrupt agency in the city. But he tied this committee in knots for 3 hours to the point where one of them finally said, "Mr. O'Malley, are you electrically wound up?" And in the end, he defied them. Moses was part of this effort to clean up Tammany Hall. O'Malley and his boss, Mayor Hyland, defeated him. And forevermore, I think the O'Malley name meant something bad to Moses.
But there was such strong sentiment for keeping the Dodgers in New York, you would have thought that that would have trumped anything that Robert Moses wanted to do. Was he that powerful?
We certainly know from Robert Caro's Power Broker that he was that powerful. There really was no more powerful public official, I think, in the history of the United States who didn't ever get a vote for anything. At one point, I think he held at least a dozen offices, controlled most of the money for development in the entire state of New York. So this guy never wanted a stadium in Brooklyn. He did not. He told his staff, make it look good. Make it look like we're working with O'Malley, but there's never going to be a stadium there.
Even though this was an ideal place because it's where the Long Island Railroad met pretty much every subway line that went into Brooklyn.
By all rights, we should be thinking about opening day at Dodger Stadium in Brooklyn today instead of in L.A.
But there was another factor here, and that was that there were no baseball teams or very few west of the Mississippi, and they were only barely west of the Mississippi. This was virgin territory because of jet airplanes, we could consider California as a place to have teams?
It's funny to think about. In 1956, it might take you 10 hours and at least one stop, if not two, to fly to L.A. But by 1958, you could fly nonstop.
Teams often traveled by train or by bus.
Yes.
Until this time.
And they really wanted two teams out there. So that's why the idea of the Giants and Dodgers both moving was so appealing to Major League Baseball.
And O'Malley couldn't have done it if Horace Stoneham hadn't agreed to go to San Francisco? Was he pulled kicking and screaming?
Horace was not pulled kicking and screaming, and neither was Walter. I think Walter went reluctantly, but by the summer of 57, both of them were ready to go. And the idea of there being one team was not attractive.
What about the other baseball owners? Were they happy at the prospect of teams moving all the way across the country?
I think some of them were jealous that Horace and Walter got the chance. Imagine going to two of the largest cities in the United States where there is no other big league athletics. You know, there are no basketball teams, no football teams. And all of a sudden, you get this market all to yourself. It was quite an opportunity.
And some of the biggest stars in baseball were moving out there. Willie Mays with the Giants.
Right, and all those great Dodgers. And if you think about what happened in some cities with expansion teams as opposed to an established team moving, these expansion teams could wait 10 years to be competitive. The Dodgers won the World Series the second year they were in Los Angeles. The people there were delirious.
So if Walter O'Malley is still hated in New York, is he much loved in Los Angeles?
I think he's the only owner who 50 years after he moved the team and decades after his death is still talked about almost every day. You know, you can find Walter O'Malley's name in the paper out there on a regular basis. What's funny is in some cases around the country, if anybody mentions a trader, they mention O'Malley. In other places where anybody mentions an innovator, they mention Walter O'Malley.
On the other hand, we got a comment on our show page from Bobby from the East Village. He said, "My father, who was born in L.A. in the 1920s, hated O'Malley because the city of Los Angeles gave away for nothing some of the most valuable land in downtown for the Dodgers to move their stadium."
Well, that's not true. O'Malley also owned, when he got to Los Angeles, Wrigley Field, which was in West L.A. It was not as much acreage, but it was very prime acreage. So when he arrived, he traded Wrigley Field on the west side for Chavez Ravine in downtown Los Angeles. He paid for all the development of the property and of the stadium. So, you know, I think he got a great deal, but it wasn't free.
But a lot of people were angered that he was evicting people from their homes to build the stadium.
Well, the story of Chavez Ravine starts 7 years before O'Malley gets there, when the county and city of Los Angeles decide to build public housing there. They moved 95% of the people out before 1955. But then, politics being what it is in Los Angeles, somebody decided that public housing was a communistic enterprise. They canceled the housing project, but there were still a dozen or so families left there. Those people were evicted to make way for the stadium. You can't deny that they suffered because of it. But it wasn't this purge of a huge number of poor families dragged kicking and screaming.
Didn't O'Malley design the new stadium for the Dodgers in Los Angeles?
He dictated the overall shape of the stadium, how it would fit into the landscape there. He was especially attuned to how the view would be from each of the seats. So when you sit in Dodger Stadium, you see the outline of mountains and palm trees, and so it's a magnificently sited stadium.
It was also a chance to build a new kind of a stadium. Were there any innovations?
Sure. I mean, people who have been there know that you park your car on the same level where your seat is, so you don't have to climb stairs, which is a classic L.A. move. There were no obstructed views in the stadium. They had amenities that no other stadium had. He made a few mistakes. One of the things he did was fail to put in water fountains. Mm. So when the stadium opened, everyone teased him and said, "You want people to pay for a drink no matter what." The water fountains went in later.
But he didn't make the same kind of mistake that Horace Stoneham made in creating Candlestick Park, a stadium that nobody wanted to play in.
Well, and Candlestick was a municipal park. And that's what's also remarkable, is O'Malley did this with his own money. People don't realize also that he almost went broke. One of the documents I found in his papers was a long letter he wrote to people in his family, his son, his daughter, and his wife, explaining how he was almost at the end of his finances and hoping to get rescued by a new lender. In the end, he did. That was Standard Oil, and they kept him going.
And then they won the World Series, and I'm sure, and they became LA's team. How important do you think the Dodgers have been to Los Angeles's development?
Let me correct it. It was Union Oil, not Standard. The Dodgers, you know, first of all, the stadium is a bit of architecture that's become iconic. It has that semi-tropical, pale blue and burnt orange coloring and graceful lines that actually are echoed in designs at Disney World, sort of modern. So it's definitely an iconic structure. The team itself knitted this really disparate community that's hundreds of square miles large and doesn't really have much of a core into a place with a central identity. That whole idea of forever blue being Dodger blue really is true. For a long time, I would say the Dodgers were the one thing everybody in L.A. had in common.
What effect do you think the Dodgers' move had on Brooklyn's development?
You know, I think it did knock the spirit out of Brooklyn for a while.
The ballpark, which everybody loved, was replaced by some of the most ugly housing that anybody could imagine. And that almost seems symbolic of what was going on.
It is, and it's also, I think, symbolic that they never got to develop the property O'Malley was targeting into the center of entertainment and retailing that he envisioned. It would be so wonderful if we had that park there.
I'm not so sure. I feel the same way about the Atlantic Yards, but that's a whole other matter. What do you think are Walter O'Malley's greatest influences on baseball?
Well, certainly he promoted integration after Branch Rickey left, and the idea that you put the best players on the field no matter what.
Even a majority-minority team.
Majority-minority. And the Dodgers kept up that tradition long after Walter was gone. You know, they were among the first to have Asian players come in from Korea and Japan. They really emphasized Hispanic players, had a development complex in Santo Domingo. They were very aggressive about international baseball, and Walter was behind that.
Well, he died 30 years ago?
1979, right.
So the game has changed an awful lot since he died.
It sure has. He anticipated a lot of what happened. I don't think he could have imagined the salaries, and I think he would be appalled by the mood at ballparks today. That for the longest time, there was only one sign in Dodger Stadium. The big show and the music they have today would have dismayed him.
I wonder what he would have made of the new Yankee Stadium and the new Citi Field, which are retro.
Well, I think he'd have been jealous of the facilities. They're sure beautiful.
After defending Walter O'Malley as much as you have, do you think you're going to need a bodyguard when you leave this building?
Well, I've told people I'm speaking at the Brooklyn Historical Society tomorrow. I need a tomato-proof suit, I think. People do have hard feelings about it, and I don't deny that O'Malley made the decision. He's the guy who took the team west.
Now, that conversation you'll have is with Walter O'Malley's son, Peter O'Malley, 1 p.m. at the Brooklyn Historical Society. And for more information, you can visit our show page at WNYC.org. The book Forever Blue, The True Story of Walter O'Malley, Baseball's Most Controversial Owner and the Dodgers of Brooklyn and Los Angeles, published by Riverhead Books. Thank you so much, Michael D'Antonio, for being with us again.
Thank you, Leonard.